Welcome to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys and a Podcast is a shout out from the margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to determine what's significant to your future and why. Welcome to another week, man.
What's going on, brothers? Good to be back.
Another expedition. And of course, for every expedition, most expeditions of Two Dope Boys, sometimes we just got to get to the prime dope boys. But on most expeditions, we have a member of our illustrious crew. And on this week, we have for a third time, a man who is Phil's good friend. And now I'm actually honored to say really becoming my good friend as well.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, really. Very genuine. I mean that. It's great. Been awesome getting to know you. Young Kim, Madbury Club, talented, brilliant dude.
Hello.
Will you give just 10 seconds, because we're growing, new people are coming on board, they might not have heard you yet.
Yeah.
Just give them like the 10, 15 second spiel.
I am a former music journalist turned marketer working with the Madbury Club, a creative house in Brooklyn that don't like to follow rules.
No, they don't, and they have an amazing space. Now that I've gotten to party at Madbury Club, I would say it is like if I was 12 and I had a budget, I would basically build the space you're in.
Like Tom Hanks and Big?
Yeah, essentially. It's like if Tom Hanks and Big had a little bit more of like a trendy sensibility, you would have Madbury Club. It's just like non-suburban Tom Hanks, which is the opposite of a brand fuck up. But now you know how we start every week. We got to start with the brand F up. And this week, sometimes we go obscure. Sometimes we play in the world of brands. Sometimes we catch a subtlety. And other times we got to sort of pile on, kick somebody while they're down in our own particular dope boys way. And this week we found somebody that, well, I mean, unfortunately she deserves it. And that is Emily Austin. She's a former Fox News reporter.
She was fired
after making some comments about Mexican folks, Jewish folks, and Chinese folks. I have to know, we have some sound here. And she's hanging out and socializing with her friends. So it wasn't like this was during a live broadcast. I just want to note, it's very interesting in conversation. We usually cover these things. Black people not specifically mentioned here.
We got to pass this.
So, the black people were off the hook. Chinese people specifically. So, actually, Korean people, young, you're totally off the hook. I got hit as a half Jew.
It's about time.
I got hit. About time. I got the direct hit on this one. Let's check out what Emily Austin, hanging out with her friends in. Do you know, Matt, like why they were filming this? We don't know why they were filming this. They're just sort of socializing. This is some B-roll. This is some kind of socializing. She's letting loose with some. With her real feelings here. Let's check this out.
No, I go, so you're stealing fucking spots from everybody else. Turn this into this huge fucking debacle. What do we got, big cap? Go.
It just proves that you can be book smarts and the dumbest person in the world on the street. Because she's a 4.5 GPA and she tweets that. No, not like, obviously the internet's gonna gang up on her and kick her off the internet and kick her back to Mexico. That was the most obvious outcome in the world. So she's an idiot.
So you think it's real?
I think that was real. She deleted her tweet. Yeah. That's fine. You can hate me for the Bieber thing, but I was right on that one.
No, I did agree with you that I think that it would be a bouncer or something, somebody that you may have known. But with the whole girl, like, I didn't even know Mexicans were that smart. Is that?
Trump Jr.
No, and I'm nice already. I know that's fucked up. Funny. I didn't mean it like that, but wow. You guys know that the Chinese guy is always the smartest guy in math class.
No, that's a good point. That's
I like that.
Not you, young.
You get yourself out with another stereotype.
She probably thinks I'm Chinese, so.
Okay, everybody.
Doesn't matter.
I look all people. I don't care if you're white, yellow, brown, purple.
She's kind of a little snitchy.
Okay. I went to school in Boca, so I know most of that. Like the way I used to talk to the Jews in Boca, they hated it because I was a server, and I just didn't care, and they would complain and bitch about everything. I gave a guy like Liberty's beer, and he was complaining to me that there was too much head, and I knew that he was a stingy asshole, and he wasn't gonna give me a tip. So I go, sir, you're the first guy that's ever complained to me about too much head. So,
did that win them over?
No, I think that I got fired like 2 weeks later.
Okay, gentlemen. I actually have to give props for the Trump Jr. line. I thought that was pretty funny by one of her cohort. We don't have to spend that much time on this one. Thoughts?
I mean, it's obvious that I don't, you know, when I see these things, I'm always like, what were you thinking? That's always my first inclination. I mean, we all know that behind closed doors, people are going to kind of make jokes and say things that they probably shouldn't say. But you're not behind closed doors. You're being taped. You're in some sort of show setting from what we can ascertain from the video. You guys just heard the audio. So it's just unbelievable that anyone would think that those comments were okay. But from a certain perspective, she probably thinks she's being an edgy, Amy Schumer-esque, funny blonde chick, you know, and it just, sorry, you weren't.
Right. I mean, it's all context, right? Like, you're a member of the media and you're representing Fox Sports. You're not a comedian. And it's the whole thing of, like, staying in your lane. But at the same time, it's, hey, she really told us how she felt. And now it's getting to the point where I'm not getting surprised. It's, of course, she works for Fox Sports. Like, even Fox Sports has Colin Cowherd. Like, and if anyone says something offensive on ESPN and they get fired from ESPN, they end up going to Fox Sports. Colin Cowherd was like, Dominicans are not smart enough to coach. He got fired. He said a bunch of other things. He went to Fox Sports. Jason Whitlock made a mess of ESPN, the undefeated, before it launched and said a lot of stupid stuff. He ended up going to Fox Sports. That's what they want. I'm surprised that they fired her. I don't know if they fired. Did they really fire her? Or was she suspended? Yeah, she's fired? Okay.
Well, the statement that they released was, they basically said, Emily has been advised that her comments were unacceptable and she's not scheduled to appear on any upcoming Fox Sports Florida or Fox Sports Sun broadcast. So this is also, you know, a regional affiliate. I mean, the only question I have, and it's always bad because with cases like this, I agree. I mean, she basically said what she felt on some level, right? So it's different. I do think that, you know, we're opening up a conversation where if everything that people say on camera or on social media is potentially a fireable offense, I understand when people sort of raise the concern of, like, you know, I mean, the reality is if people threw a camera on the three of us and track some of the things that we said potentially out of context, there could be grounds for offense in anything. So I guess the kind of anemic pushback is, like, at some point you're going to be like, ah, all right, whatever. You know what? You said what you said. But the problem is I think that's a valid perspective and a valid thing to say, but the problem is in that all of these case studies, it never works. Because how can she kind of pivot back from that as an anchor now? I mean, it's not to say maybe there's not room to come back in the future. But I do agree with you. I think that there's tension in the Fox brand, because if you're specifically luring people over who have actually explicitly said things, not in a context like this, the comment about Dominican coaches is way more offensive than this. But, you know, it's pretty standard issue. It's embarrassing. You got to watch yourself. And there's no surprise there.
Yeah. And there's power dynamic, I think.
Yeah.
To the extent when you mentioned, like, Colin Cowherd and Jason Whitlock, they're also name brand people. Like, they're personas within that sports world. And whether you're ESPN or you're Fox, or they might go on to do their own thing, they're sort of paid and compensated to be controversial. Like, you know, I would hope that someone like Skip Bayless doesn't believe half the things he says. At some level, these people are just professional trolls. Like, they just know exactly what to say in order to get us super riled up. This young lady, you know, she's unfortunate enough that she's not big enough to get the pass, you know, like, she's on a regional affiliate kind of show, kind of just making her bona fides probably in the space, and just, it's easy to make an example of her. If she was maybe like a anchor with, like, more clout, she might have gotten, like you said, like the suspension, or we're going to have you off air for a little while and then you bring her back after she does the bullshit apology or something like that. But she just wasn't big enough to withstand the heat. So it's easy to let her go or cut bait with her.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. And you're right. I mean, like I said, we all say things. I don't know if I say shit like that, but.
Well, I thought the thing that you've said about Jews in Boca.
I have said a few of those type of comments before.
Yeah.
But you know,
and we always ask you to figure out the check when we're out.
Yeah.
You know. Now this is going to be used.
All of this is going to be against us.
All right. Well, we're still at the point. We're good. We'll
grand opening, grand closing.
All right. That's the brand screw
up.
Are
we big enough, though? Are we big enough?
Well, this is how we get.
Okay.
This is how we get. All right. I mean, that's pretty basic. The last thing I say before we wrap it up, there was something just kind of shocking about something. It was just to see someone who's so young saying stuff that, like, old bigotry sounding was just weird.
Yeah, it's at least be clever with it.
Yeah,
have a new twist to it.
Exactly,
it's a little Rodney Dangerfield.
Almost. Exactly, she's like, hey, like, no respect from the Jews when I was their waiter. Hey, what about the Chinese kids? They're good at math. I didn't know Mexicans did math. I thought they were picking vegetables. I was like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah,
it was pathetic. All right, we got to get to what's up. We got to get to what's up. And for this week's what's up, we got to talk about virtual reality. And I'm not just talking about pornography virtual reality. We're talking about the whole global trend of VR, which, you know, everybody knows is a very fashionable conversation. It has been so for a long time. And it feels like now in 2016 and moving forward, it's coming a little bit more into focus. I mean, I make even the pornography joke, but that, you know, that's a strong emerging field in that market. It's a strong emerging field in filmmaking. It seems to be making the transition a bit more from sort of on the horizon to happening now, and therefore even more so on the horizon, if that makes sense. And I'm going to open this conversation and frame it by looking at a study, a virtual reality, $1 billion niche, which is a TMT Predictions 2016, which was published by Deloitte, Deloitte Global. We'll have a link to it, of course, in the show notes. And I'm just going to quote from the study to set this conversation. Deloitte Global predicts that virtual reality, VR, will have its first $1 billion year in 2016 with about $700 million in hardware sales and the remainder from content. Parenthetically, that's fascinating to me. The content category is so large. VR is likely to have multiple applications, both consumer and enterprise, in the longer term, but in 2016, we expect a vast majority of commercial activity to focus in video games, which I guess is no surprise. We estimate sales of about 2.5 million VR headsets and 6 million games sold. So this is in the near term. It makes sense that it's mostly in the video game market, but you know, virtual reality feels like something that is really actually arriving versus sort of anticipated to arrive in 2016. Young, what are your opening thoughts on this?
Well, I think VR not too long ago was kind of a joke. A lot of people thought that it was silly. Oh, look at these geeks kind of going on over there with these. And it, you do kind of end up looking silly. Like when you watch videos of people wearing it and the way they're reacting to it, it's very hard to understand. I personally don't have experience with it, but you know, one of the guys, Brian from Madbury, is big on it, and he's been preaching it for a while now.
What does he preach about it? What is it?
Just that it's trippy. That it's you really. I think it's just a different sensory stimulation that you don't get. And again, like, I haven't seen the technology, so I'm sure the technology. He's just like I don't even think he did anything exciting, but he was just. He just kept saying, oh, and then I was touching the couch that was behind me. Like, everything was in reality. It wasn't just, oh, I'm going to go into this silly simulation thing. I think we've done those things at different kind of amusement parks where you step in and you're like, oh, here, you know, move your hand. And you're going to see, you're going to move this and you're going to move that. And for us, I remember when Oculus Rift was bought for $2 billion by Mark Zuckerberg. That was kind of the moment where I said, wait, this is really going to happen.
Right. It became real in a different way. So immersive and experiential. That's interesting. It kind of reminds me of some of the first language, at least actually reading it historically for me, the first language that was used to kind of sell the internet, that isn't just sort of staring at a mainframe. It's something that you can almost go inside. Phil.
I think it's interesting these first thoughts about the internet that both of you guys referenced, because I remember being on the trading desk in like late 90s, early 2000s, and at the time the internet was still very much in its nascent stages, and you sort of had a plan. You had to build the infrastructure without knowing where it would go. Mm-hmm. And so the big conversation was around this language of broadband. And there wasn't really a use for broadband. You know, people were still using dial-up connections. There was no Wi-Fi, forget about it. But if you could at least get like this thing called broadband, which you only knew of as a faster connection to dial-up, that would open up the world for you. And we built broadband, and then we had YouTube. Like YouTube couldn't have existed without the initial structure of having a broadband network available. So when I look at virtual reality and VR applications, I agree with both you guys. I think we're just really scratching the surface, because the technology that we're building is going to be sort of the roadmap as we go forward. And I remember a decent movie, though it seems really dated in some respects, but still sort of fresh in others. If you guys remember Disclosure with Michael Douglas and Demi Moore, it's kind of like one of the last of the Michael Douglas sex movies from the 90s, when you have like Fatal Attraction and the other one with Sharon Stone, Instinct. Basic Instinct, and then he had Disclosure with Demi Moore. And there's a sex scandal at the heart of the movie, but it centers around them building a virtual reality platform where you had to go and stand on this level, and you'd float around and there'd be lights shining up at you. It was very sort of archaic, but to think that what appeared as sort of an addendum to this kind of psychosexual thriller is now coming to reality in a much more direct way, I think is really interesting. And the underlying technology is really where I think the story is. You know, like, will the technology kind of build that roadmap to make virtual reality interesting? So that's one aspect. And then the other last thing, and then we can move on a little bit, is how does virtual reality play out in sort of culture spaces, inclusive spaces, diverse spaces? I think that's a larger function of all technology, in the sense that, you know, Silicon Valley has been accused of making technology that solves the problems of a very specific subset of people.
And can't even necessarily conceive of a broader set of problems to solve.
Exactly.
Which is the kind of base question there, right?
And can virtual reality take a different perspective? Can it, even in these early stages, become more inclusive of creating backgrounds, telling stories, creating empathy around situations that will be more inclusive of other people's perspectives and worldviews? Like, that's something that's really intriguing to me, beyond just these sort of numbers around virtual reality and what it means in terms of dollars and cents.
I have a friend who's a filmmaker and journalist, and I don't know where the state of this project is now. I mean, it's a, you know, funded, established project, but I don't know how much there is to sort of say about it at the moment. But she's working on a 3D film project that would give you something of an experiential access to Darfur and to some genocidal conditions. So that might be on one end of the sort of social application. But it's interesting to me as a cultural reference point, and I just want to throw in a couple more data points from this study. But I've watched some Star Trek, maybe not as much as everybody else, so correct me if I'm wrong. So it seemed to me that in the second Star Trek, the one with the French dude or the British dude that everybody loves,
Next Generation,
Patrick Stewart,
Jean-Luc Picard,
that dude.
Jeez, dude.
I'm sorry. I'm not gonna.
He's the best Starfleet captain.
Oh, no question. That I know. But it seems to me that the holodeck is not really, like, that's the virtual reality of that world. And it's primarily used as an entertainment vehicle, which is dope, which is great. I mean, of course, who wouldn't use that? Like, if we could add, like, we're going to have a party, and there's also going to be a room that you can go in that will take you to ancient Greece. Like, of course, we're going to want that. That's great. But it is interesting as a cultural reference point that even there, in such a kind of forward-looking show, the notion that this technology would still be just sort of an immersive entertainment vehicle is interesting that that's where we cue. I just want to throw in one more stat from this global prediction, then we'll get back to you, Hyung. There's likely to be two main, this is back to the Deloitte study, quote, there are likely to be two main types of VR devices in 2016, full feature and mobile. That's fascinating to me. The former incorporates high resolution screens and are likely to cost about $350 to $500, with the price at the start of the year possibly being higher. And we anticipate around 1.75 million sales in 2016, with volumes depending heavily on initial price. Then it goes on, full feature devices will likely be assigned to be used with either the latest generation of game consoles or PCs with advanced graphic cards capable of driving high refresh rates. I think that that's just fascinating to me because, you know, and take this whatever way you want, Young, but it's like, I mean, our phones are already so distracting. Could you imagine just even like the social implications of us on the subway in New York City with now a VR experience incorporated in our phones?
Well, this is different, but remember Google Glass, like the controversy with Google Glass.
And thankfully that didn't work.
It died out. Yeah, and so the idea of people wearing things in public, although I keep envisioning a lot of people being alone.
Yeah,
just opting to just stay at their house or stay at their office and be lost in another world.
Yeah,
kind of another addiction,
right?
Whatever it may be, social, TV, or drugs, you know, whatever it is, like you're just kind of doing it by yourself. More of an isolation and escapism that is going to be readily available for you.
Definitely.
Yeah, and that worries me. You know, I mean, I think we're already in environments where people are together but alone. You know, the phone has become sort of a crutch to many of us, you know, myself included at times, when you're in a social environment and you're just kind of floating, and so you're like, okay, I'll just be on my phone for a minute. You know, it's kind of like that becomes the default. So I'm kind of curious as to what this will lead to. I mean, I think you made an amazing point, and
Young, not me.
Yeah,
unfortunately,
you never make the amazing points.
Fuck out of here! See, you could take a little humorous interaction and then escalate.
I got to take it to another step. You know,
controversy
in the non-virtual reality of the studio.
Nothing virtual about this.
Is that? And then fisticuffs and see. But we want to guard on that. Like, we're already getting isolated enough. You know, like, you know, we don't want these circumstances to become kind of the crutch to get us out there in the world. And to your point about the social causes, like, I also wouldn't—
that was me.
Yeah, to this, the Michael point now.
Boom.
You know, I wouldn't want to have a situation where I think there can be some empathy gained by using virtual reality to make you more aware of social calamity or things that are going on in the world, but you don't want it to be voyeuristic. Same time, I don't know if that's the right language, but
no,
I'm just kind of—
I think that's precisely the right language.
Questioning,
I would think
that,
if you use it in a certain way.
Yeah, we already have so much clicktivism, like people just click a like or share a post or retweet something, like, and feel as if they have ownership of that situation. This has the potential, if not harnessed correctly, to maybe lean in that direction. I don't know. I'm conflicted on those aspects of it, but it's just something to be thoughtful about.
Yeah, but I think I agree with you. The final question, though, around that, to go around with, I mean, from a business and brand perspective, I mean, it's really obvious that video games, and again, I'm not trying to sort of have humor here, but the reality is that video games and pornography are the obvious places where this is going to have a massive growth, and there's going to be a lot of investment, and money is going to be made. The question is, and I think it could go two ways. I think it could be voyeuristic, but I also think on the flip side, if you're having immersive experiences, which by definition are more kinesthetic and physical and more experiential, that might enhance like, it's different to see a disturbing image, cosign on a sentiment, or certainly, you know, retweet a tweet. If you actually are having some type of kinesthetic experience of something that might cue some type of more durable response when it as relates to social concern or even, you know, customer or brand loyalty, obviously. So I guess the final question related to that is, I mean, do you think it's possible that as this market starts to grow, could it go in a different direction? I mean, we already factor for video games and porn, they're going to blow up. But beyond that, is there a way that from a business perspective and from a development perspective, as people get kind of oversaturated on the flaws of Silicon Valley and the kind of rapidity of the problems they're quote unquote solving, is this a new space with an opportunity to maybe to actually get back to some of the first ideals of the internet of, you know, global village or whatever other kind of cliches we want to throw at it? You know, could some good come out of this?
Every technology that comes out, there's always those two things. It's always the porn industry is always the first to kind of jump on, and everyone freaks out when something comes out and says, oh, this is terrible, this is going to be a terrible thing. Maybe the guys who invented Twitter will tell you now that when they invented it, that they thought that it was going to be used to change the world.
Right.
But probably not.
Probably not.
Right? So it really kind of, I think a lot of the technology that comes out really depends on the people. Like as much as it depends on the technology and the industry and the Silicon Valleys, it's really the people who are going to determine how, if it, you know, how it's going to be used and if it's going to be used for good and if it's going to be used for bad. And I'm sure it's going to get to a point where virtual reality is not even a big deal anymore, just like it's not a big deal that we are always on our phones and everyone has a computer in their pocket. It's just, if you, it's probably going to get to a point where if you're not using virtual reality, you're a weirdo.
Yeah.
Like, why are you not, what do you mean you don't have it? And maybe that becomes like the cool hipster thing, right? Oh no, dude! Like I'm anti virtual reality.
I'm real reality. I'm RR. All right, that's what's up. The virtual world is coming at us. Let's try to steer it in positive directions. Now we got to get to what's good.
Now we want to jump right into what's good, and this is going to be a juicy topic for us. And I suspect that we'll likely scratch the surface and probably have to revisit this on another show, but I'm really excited to jump into this topic. And I guess the best way to frame it in a clean way, we might call it something different at the end, is the commercialization of the sensitive male. You know, for those who might not have had a eye on this, there's a lot of literature and a lot of actual media sites that are now dedicated to tapping into what we're going to use their language, not necessarily our own, the beta male psyche. And the ideology behind this is that, you know, there's sort of the alpha male, if one wants to use these terms. Like I said, these are not our terms, but these are the terms for the conversation that...
Well, I'm an alpha male, so I don't know. I
mean, hey, you don't know what I'm talking about.
My term.
You know? See how instantly we bristle at the idea of it?
Our backs arch like apes.
Yeah, exactly. Our hair rises at just the mere suggestion that we might not be alpha males. But this idea that men need to become more in touch with their feelings, not just toward the opposite sex or their love romantic partners, but toward each other and how they relate to one another as friends and what have you. And I think those are in and of themselves noble attributes. But the part that I think is somewhat interesting is the fact that this is becoming part of a branded extension of other content sites. The NewYork.com has literally their site is called Beta Male, where they'll have articles and conversations kind of around and engaging this new sensitivity. So what I want to do is basically, you know, just jump right into that idea that, you know, these verticals have a commercial interest around tapping into maybe not a new male sensitivity, but an existing male sensitivity. And
also inverse.com, that's another
inverse.com
site.
Inverse.com is another one. Just to give you some
data points and frames for this conversation. So you have New York Magazine one, you have inverse.com, and it's a cross-section, like you're saying.
But I want to jump immediately to you, Yun, because you actually wrote about this on a recent Medium piece that you published. So kind of give us, using the piece, kind of your thought process around this as a as a real, not phenomenon, but a real like urgency that's needed versus maybe some of those commercial aspects that we're talking about through inverse.com and through beta mail.
Sure. I'm turning 40 later this year, so it has me thinking about a lot of things. And one of the things I thought about was male friendships and the limitations of male friendships. I work with all guys, and I was thinking about just a lot of the times when I wasn't able to be there, and not just physically, because I can show up, and I think that's what a lot of men do. Oh man, you're going through something, dude. Let's go do something, and just sit there and not talk about it. And I start the piece about I knew a friend of mine had. His girlfriend had just left, had just moved out. They'd broken up. I didn't know much about their relationship, but I knew he was a mess. Someone else told me that. And he sat there and he was talking to me, and then he starts crying, and I just don't know what to do. And I'm like 10 feet away from him, watching him cry. After a certain point, I can't even watch him cry. I'm looking away, and all I'm hearing him cry. And I didn't know what to do. And I just realized, like, that's because we've never really been told, or we've never really been taught. We men know what we need, right? Mostly from women to be consoled. But I think when it comes to men, we kind of see crying as a weakness. We see, just power through it, man. Just power through it. Like, you can just, and then you think about, on a bigger society level, like, patriarchy, alpha male, and all these things that come with it, and how destructive it can be. And then you look at all the statistics of, if there's a mass shooting, it's probably a guy, right?
Or if it's a suicide.
Right,
suicide. I mean, suicide, to balance those poles there.
Because we don't know how to get help. And it's like we talk about, I think Rembert talked about in his New York piece about brotherhood, like, and the friendships, and just... I think there's only like a few male friends that I say I love you, but there's always I love you, man, or I love you, bro, and it's always in a text, right? I've never maybe like there's like a big moment, you go to a funeral or something like that, or you go to a wedding, and then you get there and you can hug each other. And it's interesting because most of you guys watched the NBA Finals, and you saw on Twitter people reacting to LeBron crying. And to J.R. Smith crying. And it's like, oh my God, that's so beautiful. Look at these strong, powerful men crying, physically powerful, and rich men crying. That's such a beautiful thing. And that's like the only time we're allowed to do that, right? Just, I think it's funerals, sports, maybe weddings, and maybe the birth of your first child.
No. That's a total pussy move.
See, there you go. See, there you go.
Yeah, I'm just kidding. I'm not trying to reinforce toxic masculinity. I just need to get some laughs on this show, all right? Everybody just needs to calm down.
Well, I did see on Twitter that, like, it's interesting that the pussy is seen as being weak when it's actually, it gives birth, can take a pounding. This is according to the tweet. Can take a pounding, can bleed once a month, and still live on.
But
while us, we get tapped on our balls and we are just out.
Yeah,
we
are
cringed over. Yeah, but the root of the word pussy does not come from the slang for vagina.
But that's not why I used it.
No, but it's what is the word, Matt? It's pussy.
Pusillanimous.
Pusillanimous, which means the same thing. It means like you're a punk. So that's actually where pussy comes from.
So that's how you meant it.
But I think
from the Latin.
Always.
I would say
know that I mean it from the Latin. Again, may I say for the second time in this episode, fuck out of here.
I think it's been reinforced a bit by masculinity.
I love how I gotta play the male jerk in the snow. No, I guess the other thing though, and part of it would reflect, like, I grew up in an area that I would say was very in Western Massachusetts. My family left New York when I was very little, went to Western Mass, and that was a community that was in a positive way, way ahead of the curve. Like, I grew up around people being openly gay, openly lesbian, even some people with, fluid gender identity. Like, it wasn't like it was everywhere, but it was not, this is not a surprise to me. I grew up with all that being normal. And part of that continuum was like this emphasis on, I would say in that community taken to an imbalanced degree of like, you know, men are like the problem. So that any manifestation of like, quote unquote, you know, all these terms, like what the fuck did they even mean? But like, you know, quote unquote, male or masculine behavior was like a problem. So I grew up in this very weird, tiny micro community where it was probably like overcorrected for. And then there was a lot of dudes that came out of that environment who was kind of like, wait a second, like, I don't, you know, I didn't want to play with dolls when I was a kid. I wanted to play with G.I. Joe. You know what I mean? Like, and that felt like another way of kind of forcing a certain thing. So like the thing that always confuses me in this conversation is really what is authentic? Because I think it could be an authentic expression to be like, maybe it is like a certain way of showing up to not have to talk and process and to just be like, let's just go get a drink or let's go do whatever, you know, quote unquote male stuff. But then at the same time, yeah, that is a cultural problem that, you know, you couldn't cry at an event in your life, or you can't be like, yo, dude, I actually just find this overwhelming, or what, you know, whatever. It's a hard balance, but I feel like a lot of the cultural conversations around miss the basic question about authenticity of expression one way or another, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, definitely. I think some of this is nature. We kind of get down to a kind of a nature versus nurture conversation. I was with some folks yesterday evening, like a small group at a friend's home, a new friend's home. And the conversation started rooted in the recent issues around campus rapes and sexual assaults and the culture of binge drinking and what that means and meant. And some of it started to get into the same space of nature versus nurture in terms of male and female gender roles and, you know, what are girls like when they're young? What are boys like when they're young? And I probably fall maybe 80% on nurture in mm-hmm. the sense that I think some of this is stuff that we all learn. You know, my example to the group yesterday was that, you know, kids don't come out of the womb knowing color distinctions. You know, we give boys blue and we give girls pink and other kind of light colors because that's what we assume are colors based on gender.
Yeah.
You know, and so they don't learn these things. They learn these things from us. They don't gravitate toward them. You know, we lived in a world of all black and white colors, for example, and gray, shades of gray, it wouldn't matter. You know, but in a real example.
But I still would never want to read 50 Shades of Grey.
There you go.
So there's the, you know, there's the innate.
That you would reject terribleness no matter where it comes from.
Yeah, fair enough. Maybe I shouldn't gender that.
Regardless of the color. Yeah, but, you know, to kind of piggyback of a personal story of my own, you know, when I pledged a fraternity in Alpha Phi Alpha Beta Chapter being the most important thing of that equation. And because that's a Howard thing. And one of my line brothers died. You know, it'll be 3 years this coming April.
Yeah.
And he had been sort of estranged from us where we didn't know the extent to how he was sick. And he had gained a ton of weight and had diabetes, wasn't taking care of himself. And then, you know, we found out collectively through his cousin that he passed away.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a big blow, you know, to someone you pledge with. It's an amazing sort of physical and psychological experience that is designed to bond you to this person for the rest of your life. And as a result of that, you know, we go to Chicago for the funeral, and myself, another one of my line brothers, sort of initiated a retreat that we now do. It happens every year. This is our second year doing it, where we bring our chapter brothers, those who can and want to come, to Vegas in our case, but not to do the usual Vegas things. Is actually very like designed and orchestrated, where we deep dive into like workshops and conversations around how we relate to one another to sort of relearn some of these things. Because the fraternity is weird, because as you go through a pledge process, which in a traditional black fraternity experience is very physical, you're taught to like suck it up and don't be a bitch and all these kind of things. And when you internalize those things as part of your physical rites of passage, when you're now 35 years old or whatever age old, and you're dealing with real life issues, these very people that you do love and brought you into the organization, you might be less prone to open up to them, because who wants to hear stop bitching? You know, not that they might say that, but it's a weird thing. And so you have to sort of repurpose your relationships with these guys, because these should be the closest one to you. Like, there's no way one of my sands should have passed away without us being even aware that he was going through what became life-ending health situations. But for whatever reason, we were unable to do that. So
yeah, I wrote that in my piece too. You hear about your male friends going through something, and I would justify myself not reaching out to them by saying, oh, he just probably needs to just figure some things out on his own, right? And then there's been other times where I talked to that friend later, and they said, you know, I just felt really alone at that time. And then it's this whole, this tremendous amount of guilt. I just want to say, I think we're living in a time when everything is being challenged and everything is being redefined. And I think manhood, masculinity, what it is to be a man is being challenged. I think a lot of it's happening in pop culture. I think the fact that Drake and the type of music that he makes, I think the fact that, you know, very sensitive, and he talks about hurt. I mean, he goes about it in a very different way, but when he first came out, a lot of people clowned him and called him soft, and he kept staying with it. And now a lot of other music is that way. You know, I think this wave of feminism, this wave of the gay rights movement, you know, a lot of kids are growing up at a time when seeing, you know, two men kiss on TV is not a big deal, right? It was a big deal for us. And
yeah, definitely.
I was incredibly homophobic growing up. I mean, if you were into hip hop, like in the 90s, you threw the F word around all the time. You know, like that Brand Nubian line, like we yelled it out pretty loud, right? Buju Banton, like we said all those things. But now, you know, these kids are growing up in a time where Frank Ocean is accepted for who he is, and he comes out and on a Tumblr post, you know, like it's I think social media has a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of good things. And they were talking about virtual reality, a lot of good things, and challenging these things. Jaden Smith, I think, in a way represents like a future. I mean, you know, of what the next generation is going to be. The fact that Kanye wears a kilt or a skirt or whatever you want to call it, right? After a while, you can't, you know, you're going to say like, oh, that's not being a man. I mean, people are still going to do it, right? But even athletes, football players, I think, are, you know, are writing pieces about how the need to be this ultra powerful man has been destructive, you know, to their development.
The two things that strike me, I'll try to condense it though, but that's interesting about this is that one, again, I think there's always a question of performativity. So like, and that authenticity question. So like, if it was a performance to be like that hard dude, and that was like the cultural signifier, and now it's like a performance to be like that, you know, I wear a kilt dude, again, where are the actual connection points? And the irony is that I feel like on one hand, we're talking about opening up and getting, you know, quote unquote, more sensitive, and owning a fuller range of male emotions. At the same time, we're also talking about, you know, like Phil, like you're talking to me about things like initiations, building community, like finding these reference points, which in some ways could be slotted as kind of like quote unquote traditional. I wouldn't frame it that way necessarily. And you hear it in some of the discourses on race, I think, or from on gender from women, of like, well, on one hand, we want, you know, men need to like open up and stop kind of like playing these games and reinforcing these roles. But then at the same time, like, you know, don't be a flake, or don't be sort of like overly kind of self-indulgent in a certain way. And then the last point, I think, is with regards to the work that we do in some respects, I'm always wondering when something like this gets pushed so broadly across the culture, that I think something that starts in real cultural change and innovation and then filters through social media, culture, pop, and everything else, it's also just a business opportunity to brand a different idea of masculinity. And how does that kind of sit with the more sort of organic changes. So I don't necessarily have an opinion on all those things. I just think that they're all just sort of complicating variables as we move this forward. That's what's good. Let's get to the crates.
All right, right now we're going to jump into digging in the crates, and this is our time to give you something that we think is relevant to you going forward. It can be a piece of music, it can be a video clip, it could be a book, it could be an old movie. As long as we think it can add value to your life, we want to share that with you. Mine comes from a modern day, I would think of him as a modern day genius. He's a doctor by trade, medical doctor by trade, a surgeon, but I think of him more as like an old school man of letters, a philosopher type of gentleman. His name is Leonard Schlein. He passed away a few years ago. He's written a ton of books, quite a few of which I've read, and they're all great. But the one I'm going to focus on, especially given our conversation around gender and masculinity and femininity, is a book called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, which details how we basically our rise to literacy seen through the lens of how comfortable we are with women and the role that femininity plays in society at any given time. And he traces this through sort of ancient times to more modern times, using the lens of literacy, and his idea of literacy is really education. There's also a couple of great talks that he's given that exist online, where he goes through great presentations about the book, but the book itself is definitely worth reading. And again, it's called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, and is written by Leonard Schlein.
I got another book, and I kept it in the theme. I haven't read a ton of her work. I've only read two books by her, but it's All About Love by Bell Hooks. Fellas, I really recommend you read it. It's a lot about kind of how to love and how maybe the way we think about love is in a very selfish way that comes from ego. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stuff that I'm trying to just work through in my relationship. And that book has definitely been, you know, very helpful. And just the whole idea of misinterpreting, you know, our misconceptions about love and our willingness to accept certain behaviors that we commit and that other people commit against us that may be wrong, and really trying to figure out how to make it right.
Bell Hooks is a genius. And,
she is.
Yeah, Schlein's an interesting dude, but Bell Hooks, very glad to see her finally actually come up on this show. I want to recommend a book, and just with the caveat that you don't necessarily have to be interested in the sort of like Buddhist angle of it, but I think it's in some ways actually it's interesting. It's connected to the Bell Hooks conversation. It's a book that came out in the 70s called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism by Trogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who was a very interesting Tibetan Buddhist teacher, because he came to the States and left his monastic identity behind and like wore a suit and tie and was actually an incredible alcoholic. But he was very adamant about teaching Buddhist teachings as he sort of understood them without the sort of cultural identity of an exotic Tibetan, and sort of confronting Western audiences on that and then teaching these things in a different way. So Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism is about the sort of like fascination of sort of exotifying certain spiritual experiences versus some of these practices of things like mindfulness meditation, which are actually incredibly embodied, pragmatic, direct. And he taught them in that manner. And he's also just very literary person. And a lot of the beat dudes and people like that studied with him. They're very drawn to him. So as a kind of cultural touch point, it's interesting because I think it says a lot about where the sort of counterculture was in the 70s. It's a interesting and provocative person who brought some of this Buddhist stuff over, which I think is kind of presented in a much more sort of gentle way now. And it's just an interesting piece of work. So Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism by Trogyam Trungpa, that is my pick from the crates for this week. Young, thank you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Can't wait to do it again soon,
It's nice to be around you, brothers.
Yeah, man.
Really,
I'm about to say, I love all y'all brothers, man. Like, I'll say that right now on the air, man.
You too, Matt.
I love y'all.
Oh, yeah, I don't see you as much, but...
Matt is absolutely included, of course.
You know, all of y'all and our extended crew, male and female, we love all y'all guys. That's why we're doing this. So never not tell someone that you love them.
Act out of love, not fear. We'll see you all on Point on Thursday. Thank you so much, guys.